Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, why the earliest science deniers found the truth so threatening and how Galileo risked his life to tell the truth. We'll spend this hour with astrophysicist Mario Livio, whose new biography of the great 17th century astronomer celebrates Galileo's faith in mathematics as the shared language of the universe. We'll learn how Galileo made his own telescopes to observe and document the heavens, and how this Renaissance man used art and even humor to insist that Copernicus was on the right track. Our conversation starts after a short break. To base your important decisions on, you know, facts, it can be frustrating to be surrounded by people whose conclusions seem to be based on what they wish to be true. Conspiracy theories, ad hominem arguments, and straight-up science denial can be maddening. But great scientists have been speaking truth to power since Galileo. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Galileo was a true Renaissance man, a gifted musician, inventor, visual artist, writer, mathematician, and astronomer. As it happens, he was also a pretty devout Catholic, but his observations of the natural world led him to a conclusion that could not be denied. No matter what the church insisted about the nature of the universe, the sun did not revolve around the earth. Today, Galileo is as legendary for his compulsion to share the truth as for his discoveries, and he may have particular relevance in this era when climate scientists reporting evidence of global warming are often treated with derision by those who fear they will lose out if we try to change the way people live. Astrophysicist and author Mario Livio writes about this in his new book, Galileo and the Science Deniers. Mario, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
What passed for science before the Renaissance? How did people try to understand the workings of the physical world?
So, you know, starting with the ancient Greeks, let's say, which, you know, they were very knowledgeable in many ways, Aristotle and Plato, they thought that to understand the world, all you need to do is sit down and think about it. They did not think of experiments. I mean, it went so far as to, you know, Aristotle thought that women actually have a different number of teeth than men. And Aristotle was married, but it never occurred to him to actually count the teeth in his wife's mouth. So they were not great believers in experiments. And this was really one of the great things that Galileo introduced, that the only way to really study nature is by experiments, very painful and you know, patient experiments, observations, and then reasoning based on the data from those experiments.
Just to acknowledge the previous work Galileo was building on, can you remind us of what Copernicus had proposed about the relationship between the sun and the earth?
Yes, so, you know, from antiquity again, you know, Aristotle and Ptolemy, they thought that everything revolved around the earth. Everything revolved around the earth, including the sun, the moon, and the other planets. The Catholic Church adopted this as its orthodoxy because it sort of, they found it fit, you know, that, you know, humans were the center of creation, and therefore, what else do you expect, that everything revolves around the earth? But then Copernicus wrote this book, and he was not the first, by the way. There was a Greek named Aristarchus who wrote this before him, but Copernicus made this, you know, into a science, wrote that, no, actually, it looks as if all the planets, including the Earth, revolve around the sun. His book got relatively little attention at the time, but, you know, people who of science, some of them read it. Kepler, the famous astronomer, read it. Galileo was completely aware of it, but it did not really raise that much noise as one could have expected.
So was it common for well-educated people after Copernicus to sort of privately acknowledge he might be right?
Yes, it was common for some people. I wouldn't say all educated people, because the influence of the Catholic Church was still very, very strong at the time. But, you know, the teacher of Kepler, for example, thought that, and there were others who thought that way, but they were still a minority.
So this book reminds us that Galileo did not make his discoveries in a cultural vacuum. How did the rise of individualism make it possible for him to even think in ways that differed from the received wisdom of the Catholic Church?
Yeah, the rise of individualism is very interesting because, again, if you go back to the ancient Greeks, they emphasized society. They didn't emphasize the individual. You know, Plato wanted to build a better society, not a better person. But in the late Renaissance, there started this rise of, you know, that people are more responsible for their own fate. They can have individual achievements and things of that nature. And that kind of allowed people like Galileo to also, you know, form opinions. People were also starting to travel a little bit more. So people started to understand that the world is a little bit more complex than thought before.
We should note here that Galileo did not believe any of his discoveries made Christian belief impossible or were incompatible with that. What did he think should happen when the Bible described some physical property of the universe or the church described some physical property of the universe that didn't actually hold up to observation?
So you make a very, very important point, because very often Galileo's fight is described as if it is a clash between science and religion. Galileo absolutely never saw it as such. He was a religious person. He actually wrote that the Bible never makes any mistakes. However, he pointed out that the Bible was not written as a science book. And he gave many, you know, pieces of evidence for that. He said, look, even the planets are not named in the Bible. The Bible is written in a language that the common people will understand, and it is written for our salvation and not as a science book. So therefore, he suggested that every time observations contradict a literal interpretation of what's in the Bible, it means that we are wrong in the interpretation and we need to change it and not take the text in the Bible literally.
He lived after Gutenberg, which means he lived in the era of movable type. What sort of access did he have to printed materials that would have informed his education?
He did have, access to, in particular, there was a rise in the printing of Greek mathematical books, and in particular, all the studies of Archimedes were printed. And he had access to that, and he was a great, great admirer of Archimedes. He's basically thought you can understand almost everything if you just study enough Archimedes. So he had access to that, and then, of course, he printed his own books. Well, not personally, but his books were printed, and thereby, you know, got a much better distribution.
His parents wanted him to be a doctor. How did Galileo end up instead pursuing astronomy and a lot of other things as well? But why did he not become a doctor?
Yeah, his father wanted him to become a doctor. And his father's motivation, I think, was more, like they say that sometimes that Jewish mothers used to want their sons to become doctors or lawyers. So it was a little bit like that. His father was a musician and a music theorist, but could never really make ends meet from that profession. And he was afraid that if his son does not have a profession that has some income, then, you know, he would not be able to live properly. So he wanted him to become a doctor, and he actually registered him to the University of Pisa to study medicine, and he started with that, but he really hated it. Medicine at the time, you know, was taught as basically a set of rules that were very rigid, and this was completely contrary to Galileo's personality. He was really a rebel, and he couldn't just take rules, which, you know, he didn't even understand why the rules were such and not different. So he listened to some lectures in mathematics, and that, you know, he became bewitched by that. And from then on, basically, he became a mathematician.
You mentioned Archimedes already. I know he also really liked Euclid. What sort of math was available in Galileo's day to help him try and make sense of his discoveries?
So the math that he knew best was geometry. And the geometry indeed came from the books of Euclid. Archimedes was the person who, you know, in today's language, we would say he used applied mathematics. He applied these mathematics to the building of machines, to do all kinds of problems, solve problems of everyday life and things like that. But Galileo was very strong in geometry. There were actually quite nice advances in algebra already at that time. But for some reason, he you know, founded most of his studies on geometry. In fact, less so than you might have expected, given that algebra already reached a variety of important findings.
His years in Padua were very important to him. What sort of climate was there at the time in Padua, intellectual climate, and what made that such a good place for him?
Yeah, Padua was belonged to the Venetian Republic, and as such, was much more open. There was much more intellectual freedom. It was much less under the control of the Roman Catholic Church. And as a result of this, he really enjoyed his time there. And of course, he also enjoyed what Venice had to offer. And this was in various areas. On one hand, in the building of instruments and things like that, because there was the arsenal in Venice where they were, you know, building ships. You know, they say that they could build a ship in a day there. So he used that, but he also was introduced to nightlife, to women, to, you know, other things and so on. So not everything was completely positive in that respect.
One of the things he did to earn money was astrology. Did he actually believe any of that?
We don't know initially, you know. At the time, all mathematicians were also asked to do astrology. The idea was that you do these things and you predict the future of various things. Medical doctors were expected to do horoscopes, to determine which kind of treatment to use on patients and things like this. We have at later times that he wrote a letter where he said that he thought that was all nonsense and probably all false.
What kinds of experiments did he carry out to investigate the properties of motion?
Yeah, this is, you know, one of, you know, Galileo is truly one of the greatest scientists to have ever lived, in addition to being a fighter for intellectual freedom. And some of his insights are almost impossible for me to even understand. So look, he wanted to study free fall. Free fall means, you know, you drop bodies from a certain height and you see how fast they fall. And he wanted, for example, to determine whether heavier balls fall faster than lighter balls, as Aristotle said, or something else. The thing was that there were no real clocks at the time. There were no stopwatches. So to measure very short times was extremely difficult. So we had to find a way to somehow dilute gravity, you know, to make the motion slower. So he came up with this idea of using inclined planes, where, you know, he would roll balls down inclined planes. And by making the angle of the plane very small, he could actually slow down the motion considerably, and that allowed him to measure times in a much more precise way than otherwise. So he did lots of experiments with that, and all of that he did before he started to do astronomy.
My guest is astrophysicist and author Mario Livio. We're talking about his new book, Galileo and the Science Deniers. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with astrophysicist and author Mario Livio, whose new book is Galileo and the Science Deniers. Mario, before the break, you were telling us that Galileo used inclined planes to study the rate at which objects would roll, depending on their weight and the speed with which that would happen. What about this story of him sort of leaning off the Tower of Pisa and dropping stuff? Did that not actually happen?
As far as I can tell, it never happened. I mean, he did drop balls from various heights. There is no question about that. He described such experiments, but there is really no real documented evidence that says that he dropped them from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, except for a biography written by one of his students. He was a student a few years before Galileo died. And he wrote that, but it's not mentioned anywhere else. And, you know, I mean, the student was very young at the time. Galileo was very old. Any one of them could have embellished that story.
All right. I want to talk about his use of new innovation. This thing designed to allow portmasters to see ships coming in from a far distance. Was Galileo the first to use a spyglass to look at the night sky?
Yes, he was not the person who invented the telescope. The telescope was invented in the Netherlands, but as soon as he heard about this, he immediately started constructing his own telescopes. And instead of, you know, watching his neighbors, he started watching the heavens. And, you know, just around the same time, there were other people who started using telescopes to watch the heavens. I mean, there was Harriot in the UK, what is currently the UK. But he really made this into a real science. And, you know, his discoveries were just incredible. Within, you know, 1 year, he discovered more than almost anybody else in a lifetime.
He found moons surrounding Jupiter. Had anyone understood that other planets had satellites before?
No, not before that. And that was a very, very strong point in favor of Copernicanism, you know, that all everything revolves around the sun. Because the people who objected to that were saying, well, look, if the Earth is just one other planet, how come that only the Earth has a moon and no other planet has a moon? And also, they thought that the Earth could not revolve around the sun and not lose its moon. And here was Jupiter, who everybody agreed was revolving around something, you know, choose your thing, the sun or on the Earth. But the fact is that it was not losing its four moons. So, you know, that was a very strong point in favor of the Copernican theory.
So one of the problems that Galileo had in, he was good at communicating things, but people didn't necessarily believe his discoveries because they didn't have such good telescopes. Literally, he would describe something he discovered and they couldn't see it with their spyglasses.
Some of them, that's true, yes. But you see, he was also in some sense the first publicist. He was very, very good at outreach. He understood that it was difficult. So first of all, you know, he wrote this little book, The Sidereal Messenger, which sold like hotcakes. I mean, it's 550 copies sold in no time. And then he also wrote instructions of how to use the telescope. And he managed to convince the Tuscan court to fund the construction of many telescopes and to send those telescopes to influential people all across Europe together with instructions and together with his book, and thereby to allow people to actually see with their own eyes what he discovered. But it is true, it remains true that, well, first of all, there were some who refused to even look through the telescope. I mean, does that remind you of something? I mean, when people say no climate change or, you know, things like that. So, yeah. So there were people who refused to even look through the telescope, thinking that it just deceives. When some people, yes, had a hard time seeing those things because, you know, these were not fantastic telescopes. I mean, he managed to reach a power more than 20 for his telescopes.
So he was a very good visual artist, good at making sketches. How did his background in drawing help him to make conclusions about what he saw on the surface of the moon?
Yeah, this is actually fantastic and also, you know, a very strong argument for people having education in both the humanities and the arts and science. You see, he was observing the moon, and Harriot, this English astronomer, was also observing the moon. Now, if you look at what Harriet drew from what he saw, it just looks like some doodles. You don't understand anything. And he did not understand what he was seeing. While Galileo, because he understood drawing, because he studied drawing, and he understood light and shadow and how those, behave, he immediately understood that what he was seeing was a rugged surface with mountains and craters, and he made these spectacular washed drawings actually showing all of that. So really his artistic education informed his science.
So, how did the Catholic Church respond to Galileo's discoveries about the moon?
So you see, there were it would be a mistake to think that there weren't other Catholic scientists. There were, in fact, at the Collegio Romano in Rome, the most important school at the time, there were a number of good mathematicians and astronomers. And they observed everything that Galileo observed. And actually, they confirmed essentially all of his observations. Now, in some places, they had a different interpretation. In the case of the moon, for example, Clavius thought that it wasn't necessarily that the surface looks like that, but that maybe it's the opacity of the moon, that in some places it is more transparent and others not, and that's why it looks to have this type of blemishes. In other cases, they referred to this thing which was called saving the appearances, which meant, yeah, well, maybe what we see can be better explained by the Copernican model, but that doesn't mean that reality is like that. It just means that it's a more convenient mathematical representation.
So, why did the church find his ideas about the Earth orbiting the sun so uniquely threatening? Was it the physics of the whole thing, or was it about him trying to sort of square his scientific observation with theology and presuming that he could solve that problem?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the reason, first of all, it did sort of dethrone the Earth from its central position when you suggest the Copernican model. But more importantly, they were really annoyed with the fact that Galileo, a scientist, would come and tell them how to interpret scripture. You see, they stuck with a literal interpretation. So, in the book of Joshua, let's say, this is a passage that was brought all the time. When Joshua asks the Lord to command the sun to stand still above the Canaanite city of Gibeon. So they say, okay, look, he commands the sun to stop and not the earth to stop. They took that to mean very literally. And they stuck with that literal interpretation, and they were unhappy with Galileo playing the theologian and saying, "No, you don't understand the language, really. It is the interpretation that you don't understand. It doesn't mean that something is wrong there."
We should pause here because modern climate deniers sometimes point to Galileo's rejection by those who believed in the conventional wisdom of the day as a point for their side, right? That those who go against the grain of mainstream science are right in the same way that Galileo was right. Where does that argument fall apart in your view?
Oh, it falls apart from the start because it's a logical fallacy. I mean, Galileo is right not because he was one against the many. He was right because he was right. It doesn't mean that every time that one stands against the many, he or she are right. In fact, most of the time they are wrong. When 97% of the scientific community, suggests that climate change not only is real, but is, most likely caused by humans. So the fact that there are few, very few who say that it is not, does not make them right. I mean, Galileo was right because he happened to be right. It's very rare that one who stands against the majority of opinion is actually right.
But you have heard his name invoked in that way, haven't you?
Yes. It's called the Galileo Gambit. Yes.
So how did he try to make the public case for his ideas?
So, at the end, he decided to write a book. And he wrote this book, The Dialogue on the Two Chief World Systems. which was written as a conversation among three friends, one who represented Galileo's opinion, one who represented a layperson, but educated layperson, and one that represented the Aristotelian view of, an earth-centric view. And in that book, he thought, well, the whole book really convinces the reader, if you read it, that if you believe in the Aristotelian system, you're probably an idiot, because the arguments in favor of Copernicanism were much stronger. However, it was pointed out to him that he would not be allowed to print such a book because all books printed had to get permission from the Catholic Church, and so he was. They convinced him, his friends, that he should write a preface and the conclusion that will almost negate everything that's in the book and basically say, oh, yeah, but at the end, we actually cannot tell. And he did that. But he was a bit naive in thinking that that would convince everybody because it didn't. I mean, the people who objected still objected.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You call that dialogue concerning the two chief systems of the world one of the most engaging science texts ever written. Besides the way it advanced good science, what makes it such a fun read?
Galileo had such a sharp tongue and an even sharper pen. So, he really ridicules this person, Simplicio, who represents the Aristotelian view. I mean, he has another book, The Assayer, which in which he's even more satirical and things. He has a story that I have to tell you. I mean, he had an argument with another Jesuit mathematician, and that Jesuit mathematician cited an old story that the ancient Babylonians cooked their eggs by whirling them very fast on slings. So Galileo said, oh, yeah, that's very interesting. So let's see, why is that happening? Because we also have slings and we have eggs and we have strong people who can whirl them around and the eggs don't cook. So what do we lack that they had? Well, he said, well, the only thing we lack is that we are not Babylonians. So it means that it is being a Babylonian that cooks the eggs.
So, like the idiot here, that the view of the Aristotelians was precisely the view of the Pope in Galileo's day. Is that right?
It is correct, yes. The Pope, by the way, liked Galileo initially. They were friends, and he received him many, many times. This is Pope Urban VIII. He really liked him. But the Pope was under this impression that, God is omnipotent, and he or it, I don't know how to say that, can do things any way God wishes. And therefore, we shouldn't decide that things are in a particular way because God could make things in ways that we cannot even understand or think about. So basically, the Pope's view was that we will never understand really nature. And that, of course, Galileo couldn't agree with that. He thought, yeah, if you do right experiment, right observations, and do the right reasoning, we can understand what's going on in nature.
And so, did the Pope understand immediately that Galileo's dialogue was casting him as the fool?
Some people say that, and you would even read it in some of the scholarly books, that it was because he put the words of the Pope in the mouth of this Aristotelian, which was also called Simplicio, which actually the name comes from an avid Aristotelian supporter, but it also kind of has a connotation of being a simpleton. So people say that maybe that's why the Pope became so annoyed. But I've seen serious research that suggests that no, maybe he thought that later, but not before Galileo was put on trial. But the Pope was absolutely furious that he thought that Galileo and others deceived him in writing this book, which at the end supported Copernicanism.
So technically, Galileo was tried because he hadn't obtained papal permission to publish this book, right? Not specifically because of the ideas contained within it?
You're right. This is why he did obtain permission, but in obtaining the permission, he first of all did not mention the fact that 17 years earlier, in 1616, he was already forbidden from formally defending or holding the Copernican ideas. And he didn't mention this when he asked for the permission. And by writing the book, which, you know, formally disobeyed that order. So it is on that he was formally convicted.
What was the worst that could have happened to him as far as punishment?
Well, he was found vehemently suspected of heresy. And that resulted, you know, in house arrest. And for 8.5 years, he was under house arrest. All his books were forbidden, were held on the index of forbidden books until the middle of the 19th century, in fact. And even books that were printed before, you know, there was no permission to reprint them again. So all of that happened. Had he been found actually not suspected of heresy, but actually heretical, he could have been burnt at the stake, as happened to Giordano Bruno in 1600 during Galileo's life.
My guest is astrophysicist and author Mario Livio. We're talking about his new book, Galileo and the Science Deniers. Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with astrophysicist and author Mario Livio about his new book, Galileo and the Science Deniers. Famously, Mario, as Galileo was sort of shuffling out of the courtroom after he was convicted on suspicion of heresy, he muttered, "And yet she moves," or "And yet it moves," like wanting to get the last word in, even though the church had sort of shut him down. What do we know about whether that actually happened?
So it so happens that I have spent a whole year researching the source of that phrase. And let me make it very clear. There is no doubt that Galileo thought that way. That is for sure. You know, here he was on his knees, you know, forced to recant essentially everything he worked on, you know, during his lifetime. So surely he thought that. But it was always also certain that he never actually said it in front of the inquisitors. That, you know, would have been just, you know, crazy on his part, you know, because it was so dangerous. So the question was, you know, where did this start? And what I discovered is that what common wisdom was by all the scholars was that there was a painting from about 2 years after Galileo died, which already had that motto on it. And because it was so short after his death, it was thought that, and in that case, it must have been known during his lifetime. So he probably said it somewhere to somebody. Well, what I discovered was that painting was almost certainly a copy of another painting, which was actually done in the 19th century. And so the very first mention of this motto is more than 100 years after Galileo's death, which I think makes it unlikely that he actually used those words. But look, like I say, there is no doubt that he thought that way. And there is also no doubt that that phrase remains even today as, you know, a very, very clear message, which says, listen, in spite of what you might think, these are the facts.
I want to clear something up. There are people who maybe have sympathy for Galileo, but feel like he sort of retracted his argument with those clarifications that you mentioned before, the prologue and the epilogue. As far as you're concerned, this dialogue that he published was an act of courage that can't be tarnished. But can you understand why people feel like maybe he was trying to have it both ways?
Listen, he was already 70 years old. And threatened with torture. What was he supposed to do? I mean, had he wanted to play it safe, he simply did not have to write the book. But he nevertheless decided to write the book and publish the book. And then, of course, when faced with the possibility of, very severe punishment and possibly even torture, which he was threatened with, then he felt that, he certainly at that point probably just gave in to intimidation.
He had one of the Medicis as a kind of patron earlier in his career. Did he still have that kind of support, powerful support, by the time he went to trial?
Yes, the Medici always supported him from the beginning to end. I mean, they changed. It wasn't the same person all the time. But yes, he had the support of like three generations of Medicis, and they supported him. But, even the Medicis were somewhat powerless against the Pope.
Hmm. All right, I want to go to the phone. Let's speak first with Gene in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Gene.
Good afternoon. I trust you can hear me, and wishing you continued safety during the pandemic.
You as well. And my we can question, hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah. So my question basically is, what kind of progress would we see in human knowledge if Galileo's findings rejected the science of the day? Because his findings rejected Aristotelian science. So how can we view human progress in that way?
Thanks for calling.
I'm not sure I exactly understand the question. I mean, what Galileo decided and wrote, I mean, was a revolution in science. It wasn't just small progress. He basically revolutionized the way we see the universe. I mean, I remind you, at the time, the whole universe was really the solar system. They didn't know of much else. Well, he actually is the one who showed that the Milky Way is made of many, many other stars, but they didn't know much about those. So his idea completely revolutionized the way we think. And science progresses sometimes by small increments and sometimes by big revolutions. And that was a revolution because it really took the Earth out of its central place in the universe and made it just be another planet like all other planets. The other thing that Galileo did, before his time, people were thinking that things on Earth and things in the heavens are completely different. On Earth, things can be corrupted, they can die, the heavens are perfect. Galileo showed, well, in the heavens, things are just the same. The Earth has a surface, the moon has a surface just like the Earth. Jupiter has other moons orbiting it. Everything else, he unified in this way the physics of the Earth with the physics of the universe.
I think it wasn't until like the 1970s that the Catholic Church officially absolved Galileo of wrongdoing. How long did it take for the science community of Galileo's day and the time after to sort of universally accept that he was correct?
The science community moved much faster, of course, than the Catholic Church. His condemnation did have a chilling effect at the time. The famous philosopher and scientist René Descartes, wrote that he was about to burn all his books after he heard what happened to Galileo. So it did, in particular in Italy, it did slow down science. But very quickly in the following century, everybody started believing in that. Now, the church, it took actually till 1992 for Pope John Paul II to announce that Galileo was right and the theologians of his day were wrong in their literal interpretation of scripture.
But the church hadn't actually acted on that literal interpretation for some time, right? Maybe they didn't make it official till 92, but science was allowed in the Catholic Church before then.
Yes, correct. There were popes even before that who started allowing books about Copernicanism to be published. And there was even a pope who, there was somebody else from the church that didn't allow such a book, and the pope overruled him.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Now we have Francis calling from Austin. Hi, Francis.
Hello. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good. What I'm wondering about is, what was the printing technology available at that time, because you had to do sketches, you had to do diagrams, you had to use Greek letters if you were doing math, and on and on and on.
What do you know about that, Mario?
So printing, was invented already in the previous century, and at his time it was already good. So he had printed books. For as long as his friend Federico Cesi, who was his supporter and who founded an academy, the Lincean Academy, funded those books, he could have those books printed by those. So yes, he definitely benefited from having printing at his disposal to print his books.
And printing diagrams and that sort of thing, do they use woodcuts?
Yeah,
and
they do. They did it. Yeah, they did all of that. Of course, it was very onerous. I mean, it was difficult to print those days. But yes, they printed diagrams. This is what also allowed the printing of the old mathematics books from the Greeks. Yeah.
Next on the line is James in Austin. Hi, James.
Hi. I was wondering if you could discuss Soeur Marie Celeste, his daughter, who had extensive correspondence with Galileo.
Thanks for calling.
Yes. So Galileo had a son and two daughters, but they were all illegitimate because he never married the person with whom he had these three children. Now, at that time, for girls to marry, they had to have a substantial dowry. And for illegitimate girls to marry, they had to have the kind of dowry that Galileo couldn't afford. So he put his two daughters in a convent. His son was in a much better situation. And he was eventually, because there was no dowry for a son, and he was eventually legitimized by the Grand Duke. From his two daughters, they both were in a convent near Arcetri, where it was Galileo's house in late years. One of them, we know very little about her, but Maria's sister, Maria Celeste, was his beloved daughter, and we have more than 100 letters written from her to Galileo. And author Dava Sobel wrote beautifully about her. She loved Galileo, and Galileo loved her, and she really took care of him. She used to send him medications. She took care of things related to his house when he was for 6 months. The first 6 months of his house arrest were not in his house. So it's a very, very moving relationship. Unfortunately, she died in her 30s from dysentery, and that was a big shock for Galileo.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So if all his books were taken away when he was under house arrest, what did he do with himself in those years?
He actually wrote one of his most important books in that year. This was the book in which he described all his experiments in mechanics. But he couldn't publish it in Italy. He tried in a few other places, and in all of those places where the Catholic Church had some influence, they couldn't be printed. But eventually the book was smuggled to the Netherlands, and there there was this publisher, Elsevier, who actually published the book. And the book became one of the most influential books in the establishment of modern physics.
What makes Galileo's story so resonant for you today that you wanted to take on his biography?
There are many things, but let me say perhaps the most important things. Unfortunately, we are fighting with science denial today as well. Galileo's was a fight for intellectual freedom. You see, the point is that it was wrong for the church to condemn him, even had he be wrong about his theories, because that's the meaning of intellectual freedom, that as long as your opinions don't hurt anybody, you should be allowed to express them. But more so, I mean, the question of science denial, when you hear about people who don't believe in climate change, or people who refuse to vaccinate their children, or if you look even unfortunately at the initial stages of the response to the current COVID-19 pandemic, where statements such as, we just have 15 cases and soon it will be down to zero, things like that, when the science points otherwise, it is very important to fight against science denial, because especially in cases when human life is at stake, or, in the case of climate change, the fate of life on Earth is at stake, to bet against the judgment of science is just unconscionable. So now, of course, when I wrote the book, there was no pandemic yet, so I don't refer to the pandemic in the book. But there was climate change, there was this business of, not vaccinating children, there were the ideas of teaching creationism in science classes together with, Darwinian evolution, things of this nature. This is really science denial. And science denial is never good. And in some cases is just incredible.
Do you think it's based in ignorance or malice?
I think mostly in ignorance. I want to believe that it's not in malice. The motivation, of course, is very different than in Galileo's time. In Galileo's time, as I said, it was mostly had to do with literal interpretations of the Bible. Today, there are some such people, especially in the case of creationist ideas. Yes, there are some. There is a religiosity component to that. But otherwise, it has to do with political conservatism, with various political considerations, we are in an election year now, so this colors the discussion. So many of such things.
Mario Livio is an astrophysicist and author of the new book, Galileo and the Science Deniers. Mario, thank you so much for making time to speak with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. And you can use any podcast app to subscribe to the Think podcast. Just do a search for KERA Think. Or listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.